Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Protests continue in Sacramento, California, following the police killing of unarmed black man, 22-year-old Stephon Clark. Clark was killed in the backyard of his grandmother. Police fired 20 shots at Mr. Clark, who was holding a cell phone, not a gun. Meanwhile, in another high-profile killing in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, of Alton Sterling, the Louisiana Attorney General announced yesterday that the two white police officers who killed Mr. Sterling will not be charged. Our guest for our ongoing Campaigners for Black Lives series is Sonia Lewis of Black Lives Matter, Sacramento. And fears of the Trump administration's moves to undermine voting rights, as well as continued pressure on immigrants, Trump's Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross announced that for the first time since 1950, a question on citizenship status will be asked of all respondents in U.S. Census questions. Wilbur Ross said that the information will help to count the percentage of the population eligible to vote. Others supporting the measure says it will only give account of immigrants in the U.S., not only give account of immigrants in the United States, but also the numbers of undocumented people living in the U.S. Opponents say it will spread fear among the immigrant and other vulnerable populations and lead to a census undercount, which will in turn have tremendous impacts. Our guest is Megan Ibarra, a member of the Northwest Detention Center Resistance and an assistant professor of geography at the University of Washington. And the hated Haitian army dismantled by Haiti's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, has now been reconstituted by Jovenel Moïse, who is the controversial president of Haiti. Jovenel Moïse is in office after a controversial election that several human rights observers said was fraudulent. Moïse has now named six in key positions in the new army who had their assets frozen by the United States under the Clinton administration for their support for the first coup against President Aristide in 1991. At least one of the six were implicated in the 1994 slaughter of thousands of Aristide supporters. This in the midst of growing concerns about repression of hate in Haiti and the return of Tonton Macoute-type violence against the impoverished population. This Tonton Macoutes existed during the Duvalier dictatorship. Our guest is Jeb Sprague, who teaches at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and is author of Globalizing the Caribbean and Paramilitarism and The Assault on Democracy in Haiti. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Chinese officials say North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledged denuclearization and to meet with Donald Trump. The Chinese foreign ministry confirmed the open secret that Kim visited Beijing this week but has since returned home. It was Kim's first trip outside North Korea since assuming power in 2011. Donald Trump tweeted he had received a message from Chinese President Xi Jinping saying the meeting with Kim went very well and that Kim was looking forward to meeting with Trump. First, Kim will meet with South Korea's president next month. The South Korean unification minister said Kim Jong-un's meeting with China helps pave the way for those to come.
I think improvement in the North Korea-China relationship ahead of the Inter-Korean Summit and U.S.-North Korea Summit will be helpful in solving the problem in the Korean Peninsula, such as denuclearization and establishment of peace.
The remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera. The Chinese Xinhua news agency reported Kim said his country wants reconciliation and cooperation with South Korea, with which it is technically still at war. The Louisiana Attorney General announced he will not bring criminal charges against two white Baton Rouge police officers in the fatal shooting of African-American Alton Sterling outside a convenience store. The killing in July of 2016 was caught on cell phone video and led to widespread protests. Kenyatta McMillan, the mother of one of Sterling's five children, said the officers killed Sterling in cold blood.
They took a human away. They took a father away. They took somebody away that did not deserve to be away. The way they killed him was in cold blood. You know it. I know it. But yes, the system has failed us.
Attorneys for Sterling family members have said federal authorities told them Officer Blaine Salamone pointed a gun at Sterling's head and threatened to kill him before their struggle began. In a summary of its findings, the Justice Department said Salamone pointed his gun at Sterling's head but didn't mention any verbal threats by the officer who ultimately killed Sterling. Officers recovered a loaded gun from Sterling's pocket. Hundreds of people angry over the fatal police shooting of 23-year-old unarmed African-American Stephon Clark tried to attend an overflow meeting of the Sacramento, California City Council called to address Clark's death. At one point, Mayor Daryl Steinberg recessed the meeting after Clark's brother, Stevante, refused to stop speaking.
Now, the mayor wants to talk to me.
The chief of police got my brother killed. He doesn't care. He shows no emotion at all.
At all.
And y'all get mad at me for not crying on the news?
Hundreds of people who couldn't get into the crowded council chambers marched to the Golden One Center, where they prevented thousands of Kings fans from entering to watch the basketball game. It was the second such disruption of a Kings game in a week. Earlier in the day, California Attorney General Javier Becerra said his office will provide independent oversight of the investigation into Clark's killing in his grandmother's backyard. An attorney for adult film star Stormy Daniels is seeking to force Donald Trump and his attorney to undergo depositions. Daniels' attorney Michael Avenatti filed the motion in federal court in California. He seeks to depose Trump and his attorney Michael Cohen about the $130,000 payment made to Stormy Daniels days before the 2016 presidential election to keep her quiet about her claim she had a sexual encounter with Trump in 2006. As precedent, the motion references the fact that former President Bill Clinton was deposed while in office in 1998 during the Paula Jones sexual harassment suit. That came after the Supreme Court ruled a sitting president is not immune from civil litigation on something that happened before taking office and was unrelated to the office. More than three dozen Wisconsin students have taken their demonstration against gun violence on the road. They launched what they're calling their 50 Miles More March from Madison to Janesville, the hometown of Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan. The students expect to arrive today.
We're walking 50 miles right up to your front door. Paul Ryan, can you hear us? Huh? Huh? We're screaming. We're dying. We're crying for some gun reform because you were not informed on gun reform. We're marching. If you don't listen, Paul, your rain will surely fall.
The students say they want a ban on military-style weapons, a ban on bump stocks that allow semi-automatic weapons to fire virtually automatically, a four-day waiting period on all gun purchases, background checks on all gun sales, and raising the legal purchasing age to 21. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. 22-year-old Stephon Clark of Sacramento, California, was shot and killed by police on March 23rd, 2018. The NAACP has said that a wake is set from 2 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 28th, at Bayside of South Sacramento Church. The NAACP and the National Action Network have also announced that a two-hour funeral for Stephon Clark is set to begin at 11 a.m. on Thursday, March 29th, also at Bayside of South Sacramento Church. The Reverend Al Sharpton, president of the National Action Network, is set to speak along with other clergy. The father of two was shot 20 times by two Sacramento police officers while in the backyard of his grandparents' home where he had been staying. He was carrying a cell phone, not a gun. Let us go to a clip now from NBC.
Anger over the deadly police shooting of an unarmed black man in Sacramento is intensifying. Hundreds of protesters blocked fans from entering a Sacramento Kings basketball game last night. They also temporarily shut down a public meeting with city leaders. It was held to discuss Stephon Clark's death 10 days ago. John Blackstone is outside City Hall with the latest on this story. John, good morning.
Good morning. Well, the mayor was forced to end the meeting early out of safety concerns when it turned into a shouting match. The police department here has invited the California Department of Justice to oversee its investigation into Clark's shooting death, but that appears to have done little to ease the city's tensions.
Stephon Clark! Stephon Clark!
Stevonte Clark led protesters in a chant of his brother Stephon's name just minutes into the Sacramento City Council's public meeting about the 22-year-old's shooting death on March 18th. Like many here, he called for an end to police violence.
It has to stop. It has to stop.
Good, good, good!
Stephon Clark was shot at 20 times in his grandmother's backyard after police mistook the cell phone he was holding for a gun.
Does this look, as you point this to our council, does this look like a gun?
The meeting's overflow crowd marched to the NBA arena where the Sacramento Kings were playing. They blocked all entrances for the second time in less than a week.
I feel powerful. I feel like we're actually doing something in this community positive.
I think we're going to grow from this event, and that's what matters.
Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn says his department is continuing its own investigation into the shooting and looking into whether officers acted improperly when they muted the audio on their body cams shortly after shooting Clark. He says the department does have a policy where officers are allowed to mute their cameras in certain situations. Still,
regardless of whether they were within policy or not, if you're already somebody in our community that didn't trust the police department, you're probably going to think, well, there's something shady about what they're doing. And that hurts us.
Right or wrong, muting it didn't help the situation.
It did not, correct.
More body cam videos are set to be released. Those were shot by officers who arrived at the scene after the shooting. Now, it's unclear when those will be released or whether they will contain the audio that was muted on the other cameras. Meanwhile, Black Lives Matter has announced that they are planning protests every day through Clark's funeral, which is set for Thursday.
And now let's just hear a brief clip of NBA basketball players speaking out about Stephon Clark's shooting.
These tragedies have to stop.
There must be accountability.
Black, white,
brown.
We are one.
We are one.
One.
We will not stick to sports.
We will not shut up and dribble.
This is bigger than basketball.
Change can be uncomfortable.
Change is necessary. We need to talk.
We need to act.
We matter.
We must unite.
Say his name.
Stephon Clark.
Stephon Clark. We must unite.
All righty. And NBA players, they're speaking out. Now, hundreds of protesters, as you heard in the clip, took over the lobby of City Hall in Sacramento during a city council meeting. And also on Tuesday night, protesters again blocked fans from entering the Golden One Center for an NBA game downtown between the Sacramento Kings and the Dallas Mavericks. Okay, so I'd like to welcome Sonia Lewis, who is with Black Lives Matter Sacramento. Sonia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Okay, Sonia, so the protests seem to be stepping up, and we'll get your view on that. But also fill us in on any specific demands from Black Lives Matter or other protesters.
Wonderful. What we are demanding from the city is, first, that there's accountability in the line of firing the officers that were involved. It's unfortunate that we are at this crossroads again. However, we know that taxpayer dollars are valuable. We know that the voice of the people is valuable. And the first thing that we need the department to do is say that enough is enough. They agree that enough is enough and that they're firing those officers. So that's our first demand. Our second demand is that there is an independent from an outside agency not associated with the police department. So we're not talking about attorney generals. We're not talking about the California Department of Justice coming in and doing these investigations. We're talking about an outside unbiased agency coming in to do an investigation.
Right. And would that outside unbiased agency, are you talking about including community members or civil rights organizations, or you haven't gotten that
Absolutely.
Far into the discussion yet?
No, that is definitely what the requirements are for that investigation. We feel that the power of the people is extremely important. We are intelligent enough as a community all around this country to look at and dissect this information respectfully and be able to come back with a wonderful conclusion as to what the outcome should be. So we should be able to turn over this information to the people and let them come back with a response. Black Lives Matter Sacramento has been working for over 3 years now with creating alternatives to police. And part of our work is requesting that our city council have an outside agency, a community commission that will address these kind of things. But it has no power at the moment. They've given us a community commission, but it has no power. So we're looking to beef that up and make sure that there's more power given to the people.
Right. And we know that for years. I mean, I recall several years ago, now the late Michael Zinzin in Los Angeles fighting for a community board, a police board that would be able to hold police officers accountable. But we really haven't seen that kind of thing established or certainly be given any power, even if a board, as you say, a community commission has been set up. What about this turning off of the body cam that apparently happened during this shooting?
Right. Again, unfortunate. Our department is showing us its face and its true colors. While the chief of police says that it within their policy at certain periods during investigations that it is allowed for officers to mute their body cameras, that just lends to the non-transparency that we are seeking, that leads to the non-transparency that he is claiming he wants to bring to the community. If you already distrust the police and what they're doing, why would you add fuel to the fire by muting your body cam? I just, you know, at the end of the day, when you think about that aspect of it in and of itself, there's something that is being hidden. And we have to look at that and address it head on rather than hiding it and pretending that these problems don't exist.
Yeah. And what about some of the family members have raised of Stephon Clark, this business about police being trained to shoot to kill as
Absolutely.
Opposed to, you know, disarming in some other way?
Yes, absolutely. And we, like I said, we've been going back and forth with this with our city council. We've been going back and forth with the mayor, with the police department in regards to how do we de-escalate rather than escalate situations. If you had two officers on the ground looking for a suspect and you had a sheriff helicopter in the air pointing them in the direction of where the suspect is, one thing we know for sure is that the helicopter has a very bright light on it. And one thing you didn't see in the video was assistance from that helicopter and sending those officers into a blind, dark backyard. So we have to talk about those kind of things. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that we, you know, find ourselves with two seemingly inexperienced officers who made a reckless and inappropriate decision, because at the end of the day, that's what transpired. They could have waited for backup. We're talking about property damage. We're not talking about someone that they were being shot at. We're talking about property damage. And so if we're talking about something that potentially could have been a misdemeanor crime, why shoot?
Yeah, and the thing is, I mean, clearly a property damage is not a death sentence. It shouldn't,
right.
Doesn't bring the death penalty. But, you know, this isn't the first Absolutely. Instance that we have seen of police officers allegedly mistaking a cell phone for a gun.
No.
Right. Yeah.
You know, in looking at the video, I know that the family, I'm a personal extended member of the family.
Uh-huh.
And they can't even get to a point of looking at the video. At the end of the day, to them, it's pointless to even look at the video because the evidence is clear that one, it was excessive. Two, it was overkill. And three, you didn't have a weapon.
Yeah.
So when you look at those three things together, you have a rush to judgment. You know, show me your hands, and then it was gun, 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 and the shots were being fired simultaneously.
Yeah.
That's disheartening to me as a mother. I have six boys. It's extremely disheartening that the slightest move we make, no matter how much we prepare and talk to our children, the slightest move we make can get you dead, you know?
That's right.
It's unacceptable.
Yeah, well, our guest is Sonia Lewis of Black Lives Matter Sacramento, and we are discussing the latest shooting that has taken place there, police killing of 22-year-old black youth, Stephon Clark. And I'll have to say, for all of us here at Sojourner Truth, Sonia, we are very sorry for your loss as a family member in your extended family and also to Stephon's family. And what you said about, you know, because I'm a mother. I have a daughter mm-hmm. Who is a black. We are of Afro-Caribbean descent. But,
right.
you know, you do worry every time your children leave the house, basically,
Absolutely.
Whether they're going to come back alive. And you think of Tamir Rice, for example, and what
right.
happened with him and how rapidly he was killed. But the other thing also is just yesterday, I think it was yesterday, that the attorney general in Louisiana said that Alton Sterling, who's, again, the video went viral on that. There were national protests when he was right. killed by police officers. And now the two white police officers who killed Alton Sterling will not be charged. So put this right. in the broader national context for us, because frankly speaking, just as a black mom myself, you get really, it's like, here we go again. You get sick and mm-hmm. tired of seeing unarmed black, you know, youth, black people being killed, and then there's no accountability. Sonia.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that is an outcry nationwide and even worldwide to a certain degree. But definitely here in America, we have a problem with law enforcement policing black bodies. And that's a different system because we live in two different Americas. There are a separate set of rules for black folks in America. And you know, respectfully, it doesn't matter if you are African-American descent and your ancestry were slaves that came to this country, or Afro-Caribbean like yourself, or a recent and more recent immigrant from Africa. Our policing system sees black skin, black bodies as less valuable. And that is culturally and historically embedded in our law enforcement system. You know, here in America, our law enforcement system from the beginning of its inception was slave patrol. And so we have to really delve into that and have a conversation about race, because we know that every move they make, every police bill of rights, every police union, they are based on that foundation that we have the power and that there's nothing anyone else can, you know, say or do to stop us from working under the auspice of protecting and serving. But at the end of the day, their life is more important than our life. So if they feel threatened, regardless if there's a threat or not, they can always fall back on, I was afraid. I fear for my life, because that's the guise that protects them.
That's right. And also looking at this movement now of young people, we saw that on March 24th with the March for Our Lives. And likely the estimates are around 2 million people or more, you know, marching against gun violence. And yesterday on our show, we heard the speech by the 11-year-old girl from Virginia talking about a double standard, really, when it comes to the lives of, you know, Black women and girls. And I wonder how you see, you know, the relationship between these kinds of protests, the Black Lives Matter protests against police violence, and people who are talking about gun violence in March for Our Lives.
Absolutely. I definitely personally see that there's a correlation. However, I don't think that our government, I know for sure that our government is separating the two. They are not even considering state-sanctioned violence, because that's what police brutality is, excessive force, murder by cop. That's state-sanctioned. The state has given permission to officers to shoot at will based on what they assess when they arrive on the scene. Conversely, when you have violence by the community on the community, and then addressing the issue of gun violence and safety. I think that people are not looking at the correlations and how they're definitely interwoven and connected. I am extremely proud of our youth here in Sacramento in particular, because this has organically grown out of their voice. This has organically become their fight. And I'm extremely proud of the foundation that we've laid here in Sacramento. It's been a 4-year, you know, fight since we've been a chapter with Black Lives Matter Sacramento. But to now see the younger generation take that that light and go forward, similarly with the March for Our Lives, seeing young people all across this nation. Unfortunately, I wish that we had the numbers behind us when we talk about police state-sanctioned violence, that the outcry has been given to those individuals marching for March for Our Lives.
Yeah, and I just wanted to ask about that as well. You know, yesterday on our show, we spoke with someone from Dream Defenders in Florida, and they were talking about how some of the Parkland students in Parkland, Florida, whose school, of course, that horrific massacre took place, had some of them at least had come out in support of the work of their work and of Black Lives Matter and police shootings, you know, that sort of thing. And that was work that was going to continue, because you're absolutely right. I mean, the numbers of people that of young people and high school students that you saw coming out, as you say, were far greater, right? Around March for Our Lives, and not specifically in this situation. And that tells us something, right? But it also tells us about the work that really needs to be done here. So I wonder some final thoughts from you, and also just the reaction. I mean, the Alton Sterling thing was just, I mean, it's like person after person after person after person. And you see police officers basically getting away with murder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The data is there. The numbers and the statistics are there. I think I looked at some statistics yesterday as I was preparing for another interview. 50 individuals have been murdered by mass shooting. 253 have been murdered by cop this year, 2018. We are into the middle of March. So we're less than 90 days in to 2018, and you have 253 killings by cop in this country.
Wow.
So think, you know, we think about that in perspective. You had, you know, millions of people come out for March for Your Life, and every time we have an event, we can sometimes barely get 100. You know, with the murder of Stephon Clark in our recent protests, we've had numbers. And those numbers have been so effective so that people in the city are now uncomfortable every time that there is a protest, because we're making sure that we are leaving an impression upon the minds of people in the city who sometimes just go about their daily business and go to Kings games, right? Pay our money. We have the privilege of, and sometimes we feel uncomfortable because that privilege has been taken away from us. But Stephon and his children can't get that privilege back. And that's what we want people to realize. When I think about Alton Sterling, it's the same story every time. The officers get off. We often chant during our protest, same story every time, being black is not a crime. And we say being black is not a crime, but the reality, it is. And every time this happens, they get off. And that's what we have to change. We have to change that paradigm. And in changing that paradigm, you have to go after DAs who investigate these incidences. You have to go after police unions. You have to go after police Bill of Rights in whatever states that these things are transpiring in, because that's where the power of the police department and gives them discretion to use excuses for these kind of killings.
Yeah. And just finally, just in terms of how the family members are doing, I mean, the nation saw the heartbreak of Stephon's right. grandmother. And yeah. what a lot of people really don't get is that when you're a family member and this kind of thing happens, you know, yeah. the heartbreak, the emotional toll, I'm thinking of the police beating, not the death. He fought back, which likely saved his life, of Tyre Carroll in by 26 police officers in Philadelphia mm-hmm. because he was riding his bike the wrong way on his grandmother's street, right? Yeah. And the Tyre's grandmother, Nancy Carroll, her health went downhill from that. And Nancy yeah. Carroll recently died, you know, last month. Really sad. But also, wow. it has an emotional impact and a physical, mental impact of the wider community as well. It creates a kind of a PTSD, and your heart hurts and yeah, the lump gets in your throat, as is in mine right now. I mean, it really yeah. has that immediate impact on folks.
It does. You know, Joy DeGruy, author, post-traumatic slave syndrome, speaks directly to that in regards to what we experience as trauma based on the things that are coming to us in our lifetimes. And that's a reality. You know, I didn't realize that the grandmother of the gentleman in Philadelphia had recently died, but I think about the young woman, the daughter of Eric Garner, who died.
Oh, yes,
you know,
Erica.
Last year. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. When you think about that trauma, it shortens our lives.
It does.
And we have to address those kind of issues. Right now, Grandma is extremely grieving. She's trying to keep busy. She doesn't want to, you know, be in the front of the media and be a public spectacle. I heard her say, I don't want this to be a circus. Whereas his brother is grieving in a different kind of way. This is a young man that is experiencing the pain of trauma. And every time he's in the public eye, he's seeking the attention of the public because he wants them to have an outcry just like he's outcrying. Whereas their mom is in a completely different phase of trauma and mourning, right? So yeah. we can't predict what mourning looks like. We can't say that everyone is going to mourn in the same process, but it is a process. And we have to get to that place of being not comfortable, because I don't think anyone who's lost a child is ever going to be comfortable with that reality, but being okay to continue living.
Right. Well, on that note, Sonia Lewis, we're going to have to leave it there. But Sonia, for people who want to support the efforts of Black Lives Matter, Sacramento, and your work, what should they do?
They should definitely visit our Facebook page. It is extremely active. We have a link on there for individuals who may want to make a monetary donation. There are always events going on where they can join various actions. For those individuals who can't get out in the street and pound the pavement, like we do, you know, my 47-year-old body is out there marching. My 47-year-old body, along with my children and my family, my husband, we get out there and we make sure that we are present. They can do those things as well, but yeah. We often have wish list for various events that people can make purchases for us. We have letter writing campaigns, phone calling campaigns. There are lots of things that we're doing on the ground. We have about 13 people that we're fighting for right now. And so we lift those names constantly, and we're constantly in the public eye making sure that their stories don't go unheard as well or get forgotten.
Right. Well, Sonia Lewis, thank you for that. And we want to thank Black Lives Matter Los Angeles for partnering with us for our weekly series, Campaigners for Black Lives. And we here at Sojourner Truth will say his name, Stephon Clark. Thank you.
Stephon Clark.
Difficult. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short station break. And when we return, Trump's latest attack, his administration's latest attack, some say the efforts to make America white again. Not that America was ever white, only because the land was taken from Native American nations. Anyway, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Shot him in the back. Now it's a crime to be black. And don't you act surprised when it gets vandalized. Now call it what it is, call it what it is, call it what it is. Murder. Now there's good cops and there's bad cops. White cops, black cops. But call it what it is, call it what it is, call it what it is. Murder.
The artist Ben Harper, the song Murder, and Sojourner Truth or listeners for a while might remember that Ben Harper premiered that song on Sojourner Truth a while back. I think it was after the Michael Brown killing. He came into studio and actually worked with us to premiere that song. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. You can also check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the city of Sacramento in Northern California. Also, I'd like to remind people that the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is picking up. For our listeners around the country, you could also go to the Poor People's Campaign website and you could sign a pledge form and find out where events are happening in your local area. Now, on Monday, the Trump administration's Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross announced that a citizenship question would be included in the 2020 census, asking responders if they are a legal U.S. citizen. According to the Congressional Research Service, no census has collected citizenship data from the entire population since 1950. And now the possibility of bringing that back, that question after decades, especially at a time of such political strife around immigration, is inciting fear in undocumented communities who have already been burned by the Trump administration on DACA and on TPS, and also in immigrant communities generally, because we are now hearing cases of green card holders who are getting deported and some talk of naturalized citizens perhaps being the possibility that they too could be deported. There are now worries that immigrants and other vulnerable populations will avoid taking part in the census altogether, and the ramifications of not having an accurate count of the population in certain districts, especially districts of color, are serious. So we are going to discuss all of this and more with our guests. I'd like to welcome Megan Ibarra. She is a core member of the Northwest Detention Center Resistance and an assistant professor of geography at the University of Washington. She researches questions of race and nature as they relate to migration, borderlands, and conservation. Her first book, Green Wars, Conservation and the Decolonization in Guatemala's Maya Forest, was published just last December. Megan, welcome.
Good morning.
Okay, so Megan, tell us, what is the impact of this move by the Trump administration?
I mean, I think the first thing that is really fascinating about this is we don't have a good sense of what it would mean to go back and add this question on. And in fact, the census process, because it happens once every 10 years, my understanding is that they've already sort of started the pilot version of the census without the citizenship question. But we know, you know, when we talk about immigrant communities, I think it's really important to understand that within a single household, within communities, there are not just, you know, you can have someone who is undocumented, someone who is a DACA beneficiary, and multiple citizens who are all in the same household. So what we talk about is a chilling effect that happens not just for people who are undocumented, but also for people who are U.S. citizens who are trying to protect their loved ones. Who don't have the benefit of U.S. citizenship, whether they are documented or undocumented. And that's a really broad issue in communities of color. We tend to think about this as Latinx communities, but we know that the vast majority of folks who are undocumented actually came to the U.S. legally and overstayed a visa or other permission. That's very, very common also in Asian Pacific Islander communities. Where we are up here in Washington, we have a number of communities who were resettled as refugees, many of them from the Horn of Africa. And if they haven't regularized their status, they could be at risk and therefore may also be participating at a lower rate in the census.
Right. And we know already, you know, Haitians and others have been, you know, denied continuing of the TPS status. And apparently now there's a move against immigrants from Liberia and their status under attack there. And Baji, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, there are addressing some of those issues. But Megan, we know that census figures, you know, are used to determine the numbers of representatives a state or has in Congress, the U.S. Congress, but also in state legislatures and voting and local bodies, as well as to determine the amount of money allocated for things like schools and hospitals. But also, so there's a lot of danger there, very serious danger there. But also, Trump's Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, he said that the information will help to count the percentage of the population eligible to vote. And others are saying, yeah, it'll also give us a realistic picture of how many undocumented immigrants are in the United States. So your comment on that, because it does seem to be a move, an attack on several different fronts, including dampening or undermining people's right to vote and ramping up the attack on immigrants generally and undocumented immigrants in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a particular, and here I'm speaking to the comments that have been made by the Trump administration, you know, really doesn't make a lot of sense. So the U.S. Census Bureau runs a number of different surveys, and one of them that they run that's called the American Community Survey actually does ask rather detailed questions about immigration status. So the notion that the U.S. government isn't already conducting surveys and doesn't already have a decent amount of information about people's immigrant status
is simply unfounded. I mean, even just from the perspective of the federal government itself. So, you know, I think this is part of a broader trend we're seeing where the people who are representing to us what the federal government is and is not doing, you know, these seem to be folks who actually are unfamiliar with the work of the Census Bureau thus far.
Yeah, but you know what? I happen to think that they know exactly what they're doing. And you know what I mean? This attack is very, very pointed. And it's not because they didn't know some piece of information. They know very well what it is they're up to. Just a final comment from you, Megan Ibarra.
So I think what I wanted to really emphasize is that this is not just an issue at the federal level, but this is also an issue of mistrust that has been earned or you know, trust that has really been eroded. A core member of our group, Maro Mora Villalpando, her you know, deportation proceedings notification from ICE, because the Washington State Department of Licensing gave out her home address to ICE. There was no warrant. And it's important to understand that this was after Democratic Governor Jay Inslee of the state of Washington signed an executive order saying that state and local governments should not collaborate with ICE without a warrant. So they did so in contravention of the executive order. So what we're seeing is that people are absolutely rationally refusing to do things like give information for their driver's license, which they need to get insurance because they know that it's being used against them, regardless of any promises that the government has made.
Absolutely.
And that places all of our public safety at risk. The other just brief comment that I wanted to make is that all of this talk about voting is, of course, very important. But, you know, in the context of climate change that we're concerned about in Washington and similar phenomena are going on in California, the undercounting of communities of color has major, major implications for FEMA and emergency management. What we're going to see over the next 10 years, if the census plays out the way that the Trump administration hopes it is, is that we will undercount the number of people who need evacuation and safety services, particularly what we saw last summer was an issue of wildfires and the continuing issue of hurricanes and other major weather events. And so this is not just a voting suppression issue. This is something that is going to place our lives on the line if the Trump administration is able to move forward with undercounting communities of color.
Right. Well, it is all of the above. And for people who don't think voting is important, to me, look at all the efforts that are made to suppress the vote. But you raise a very good point about really refugees from climate change. And we could do a whole other segment on that. But we are going to have to leave it there. Megan Ibarra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, now we turn our attention to Haiti. The hated Haitian army, dismantled by Haiti's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, has been reconstituted by Jovenel Moïse, who is the controversial president of Haiti. And some of the people that he has put basically in charge of the army in key positions are people who participated in the first coup against President Aristide in 1991 and also in the 1994 slaughter of thousands of Aristide supporters. Now, here to discuss what is going on, the implications of all of this, I'd like to welcome Dr. Jeb Sprague. He teaches at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of Globalizing the Caribbean and Paramilitarism and the Assault on Democracy in Haiti. Jeb, welcome.
Hi, Marguerite. Thank you for having me.
Right. Okay. And thank you for giving my Haitian name as Marguerite. Okay. Jeb, so what's happening here? You've got six people in key positions in the new army, and already there are a lot of fears about this army being reconstituted in the first place, right, given their history and what this might mean now for the movement on the ground that's trying to bring back democracy to Haiti. Jeb.
It's even coming out in the mainstream media, the contradiction of this, of rebuilding what they're calling a new army, a new sanitized military. But it's so clear, this contradiction, when you are attempting to do that, but yet you have these guys that were involved in the Cedras dictatorship and the Rabateau massacre in the 1990s. And so, yeah, these six different officials that have been named as heading up this new military force, where the government is putting aside $8.5 million this year on this new army in a country that faces so many other problems that the government needs to put resources and energy towards. So I'll just mention two of the officials, since we have just a few minutes here. Colonel John Robert Gabriel, who was actually convicted. He was outside of the country. He was refusing to return, but there were trials that were held, Rabateau massacre trials, for the first time in the history of the country. They were aired on public television, where VHS cassettes would be driven from Rabateau to Port-au-Prince and played on Haiti's public television channel. And so people in the country were learning, and or they were seeing the faces behind these crimes and learning about the financial and activities behind the scenes. And so this guy, Gabriel, he was the secretary to the high command of the army under the Cedras regime. And so that massacre, the military carried out the massacre against dozens of democracy activists in this Rabateau lower income neighborhood in Gonaïve, and the FRAP paramilitaries were also involved. Another one of the guys is Sadrak Santil, and he headed the motorized division, the armored vehicle group within the Haitian military at the time, which we know the country, that the military was never going to be used to repel an invasion from the Dominican Republic or repel an American invasion. That was never the purpose of the military during the 20th century. The purpose of the military was always for internal repression. Ever since the end of the U.S. occupation in the early 20th century, when they left, they helped construct this new military, this proxy military force. And so both of these individuals were part of the Cedras high command. They accompanied him during the failed UN brokered negotiations, the Governor Islands Accord, that was supposed to restore Aristide in October of 1993, but that failed as a lot of people were being assassinated. Some of Aristide's officials that returned to try to help in this transition were also assassinated.
Yeah. And, you know, Jeb, I just returned from Haiti, actually, early Sunday morning. And when you mentioned the $8.5 million for the new army, when I was there, I visited a market where a lot of the impoverished women were jam-packed, government-owned place. There was a huge fire. There's these suspicious fires now happening against these market women. And the government isn't doing anything. Right. Those women lost everything and they still owe money to the banks. But yet here is Jovenel Moïse spending $8.5 million for a new army. And also just today, I saw a report about a journalist who has gone missing and nobody knows where he is. Recently, he's been missing since March 14th when he went to cover a protest that was happening. A protest that was happening. And when I was in Haiti, I also visited another journalist who was shot, likely, I think, at that same protest. So, you know, he's an independent, reported that he is an independent journalist. So just some final thoughts from you, because it does seem as though that era from the Duvalier period of those Tonton Macoute attacks on the impoverished population are stepping up again. Jeb.
Yeah. And you're speaking from a perspective that is concerned with the lives of poor people and the majority population. But when we look at this military, the priority is on elite concerns. And you see different competing elites and these conditions that they're trying to bring about. So Haiti has high unemployment, a large part of the population is structurally marginalized from the global capitalist economy, and then within the country, the voter election turnout since the earthquake under the new right wing establishment in the country is around 20% of the voting age population is turning out in elections. That's compared to 60 to 70 or higher percentages under the Democratic interregnum. If we look at the candidates who won that were opposed to Duvalierism. So there's this new condition in the country where there's low voter turnout. A large part of the population is still structurally marginalized. So for elites, they need this mechanism for internal repression when the popular movement is mobilizing. And so what they're debating now, and we can see this debate being carried out in the Miami Herald and a lot of other newspapers covering this, is what's the best way of in going about and rebuilding this military. Various U.S. officials, they're upset because the government has been so brazen in appointing these officials to the new military. They don't like that sort of embarrassment. And so you see a lot of them quoted in media outlets as now, you know, opposing how the Haitian government is doing this. But in fact, we look at the history of these people, like Ambassador James Foley. He oversaw the 2004 coup and the insertion of 400 ex-army paramilitaries into the police force that we know through WikiLeaks. He was doing that in 2004, 2005.
Yeah, and Jeb, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but your point is well put, because we know that the U.S. has been up to their eyeballs, certainly with the second coup against President Aristide and a lot of this. You got short thrift today because we ran a little long on our earlier segment. So, Jeb, we'll have you back very, very soon, okay? Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Today's show produced by myself, Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team. Sherelle Withers, our intern, assistant producer Stephanie Case, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, our engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Stay tuned for Rising Up. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.